isn't it? Yeah. No one is badder. Wow, that's it. So, good morning, Dr. Wee. Nice to see you here. And it's always nice to come travel around as a Buddhist monk. You're always meeting good old friends, yeah? One of the great things about being a Buddhist monk, especially after you've been coming to a place for a few years, you start to know some of the faces, you know some of the people very well, and that's always great to do. So I'm very pleased to come here and to kind of build up a little bit of a relationship with the BGF. That's always a wonderful thing to do. And today is, I think, an especially auspicious occasion. It is the 100-year birth anniversary, is that right? Yeah? Okay, 100-year birth anniversary of Dr. Kesari Dhammananda. And I know not that much about Dr. Dhammananda because I have actually never personally met him, but you hear stories, yeah? And one of the things about such a towering figure in Malaysia especially, but also around the world in many other places, is that when someone is so large than life personality, you get to hear about them, you get to understand a little bit about their life. And he came to Malaysia in 1952, and so ever since I have been coming to Malaysia, I always meet people who praise Dr. Kesari Dhammananda as someone very special. And everyone, a lot of people say they started out their Buddhist practice with Dr. Kesari Dhammananda. He was their first teacher. He was the one who got them established on the Buddhist path. Yeah. Again and again I meet this. And again and again, the more I understand what an important figure he was for Buddhism in Malaysia, in his both his conduct, of course, but also in his ability to deliver the message of the Dhamma. One of the people who speaks very warmly about Kesari Dhammananda is Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm, he doesn't kind of take any prisoners. And he tends to be honest about people, yeah? And it's actually not that often that he praises other monastics. But Kesari Dhammananda is one of the monastics that he praised. And I think one of the reasons for that is because Kesari Dhammananda was famous for his good sense of humor. Is that right? Yeah. Ajahn Brahm also famous for his good sense of humor. Yeah. So, whoa, that really kind of works out really nicely. And this is a kind of, so Ajahn Brahm always praised him as a monk of integrity. When you are a monk, you get to see other monks more closely, so you know better whether they have a real integrity or not. And Ajahn Brahm always praised him as a monk of integrity and a monk with a good Dhamma qualities. So what a wonderful thing that is. And of course, if you are someone who has spread the Dhamma to so many people take him as your teacher, what that makes him, it makes him really a Kalyana Mitta. Yeah, you know the word Kalyana Mitta? Anyone does not know the word Kalyana Mitta? Kalyana Mitta means good friendship, yeah, good friend. Like a spiritual friend, one who enables you, allows you access to the Buddhist teachings and allows you the ability then to practice in accordance with those things. And this is what Kesari Dhammananda has been. It's been a Kalyana Mitta for so many people. And this is what makes it such a wonderful thing to celebrate, to think back in gratitude on what he has actually given to our society, both in Malaysia, but also outside. And this idea of Kalyana Mitta is actually extremely important on the Buddhist path. Sometimes people don't quite grasp how important it is, yeah? But one of the very famous sayings you may know from the suttas is where the Venerable Ananda goes to the Buddha and he says, whoa, I have understood. Kalyana Mitta is 50% of the holy life, yeah? Or half of the holy life, maybe not 50%, half the holy life. And the Buddha says, wait, hold on, Ananda, you haven't really understood this, yeah? Kalyana Mitta is 100% of the holy life. And when I first read that, I always like to tell them, I thought, yeah, the Buddha is exaggerating a bit. that's how you think, yeah. But the Buddha doesn't really exaggerate. When the Buddha says things, he means what he's saying. This, when the Buddha says 100%, he means 100%. This is not random stuff just kind of put into the suttas. It's just my own conceit. I think that I know what the Buddha is talking about. And after a while, it kind of became clear to me why it is the case, why spiritual friendship is such an extraordinarily important part of the Buddhist path. And when you read the suttas very broadly, I've read the suttas kind of in many different ways, you know, upside down, sideways, all kind of different ways I read the suttas. I'm just giving you kind of an idea of how often I read these texts. And after a while, it starts to become clear to you how this fits into the broader context. Very often, the Buddha says that Kalyanamitta is at the very base, the very foundation of the Buddhist path. Everything else develops from that. And that is why it is 100%. Yeah? The Buddha says that the Buddhist idea of non-self, of anatta, anatta means that there is no stable, inherent condition inside of us that is always there to guide us in the right way. We don't have any essence that is there to kind of say, okay, this is Dhamma, this is Buddha, this is what you should be doing. We are at the mercy of conditions and circumstances around us. And because we are 100% at the mercy of the conditions and circumstances around us, it means that unless we get the Dhamma from the outsider, unless we get it to hear it from somewhere, we're going to be drifting around in samsara like a ship on the ocean without a rudder, drifting here, drifting there, depending on the prevailing conditions, unless the Dhamma comes along and says, this is how you should live your life, this is what is really sensible to do, this is how you achieve happiness, this is how you avoid suffering in life. Unless the Dhamma, unless the Kalyanamitta comes in and tells us this, we're still going to be drifting around in samsara because there is no core inside of us that gives us clear directions and heads us in the right way. Yeah, so it is. That's why it is 100%, because without it, there is no practice. There is no real happiness. There is no real spiritual life. All of that falls away unless we have the Kalyanamitta. And once you start to get this, you start to understand how incredibly powerful it is, why the Buddha is so important, why Kesara Dhammananda is important, why all these other teachers that we have are so important, because they are what guide us in the right way. And I always say to people that if you want to succeed in a Dhamma practice, if you want to get real happiness out of these teachings, if you want to reduce in suffering, come back to the Dhamma. Time and again, yeah? Day, moment after moment, week after week, listen to a talk, read a little sutta, read a little verse in the Dhammapada. Where is that person who only had read one little verse in the Dhammapada? She's, okay. Sorry. And that's enough sometimes to inspire you, to remind you what actually is important in life, what is truly valuable in life. And this will uphold you and make ensure that you're practicing in the right direction. Come back again and again and again. Yeah, allow yourself to be brainwashed, as I like to say. Are you ready to be brainwashed? Brainwashing is good. As long as you have the right kind of brainwashing, it's good to be brainwashed. Don't be afraid of brainwashing. You're brainwashed anyway. Yeah, we can't avoid being brainwashed. Brainwashing is part of life. So make sure you get the good brainwashing. Choose your brainwashing. That is what it comes down to. So, and if you do that, then things start to happen in your life and things start to really come out. You listen to the Kalyanamitta, you listen to Venerable Kesara Dhammananda, because you listen to the teachings, you hear it again and again, confidence and faith in these teachings start to arise. But it's true what the Buddha is saying. It makes such good sense, yeah. If we do bad things, we feel bad about ourselves. We do good things, we feel good about ourselves. Is that true? It's true for me, yeah. It's when I say, that's why I try to say nice things when I come here, so I feel good about myself afterwards. If I say bad things, yeah, I feel bad afterwards. It's true for all of us. We feel bad about ourselves if we do bad things. It's so simple, it's so basic, and so, but actually also so obvious. When you hear this teaching, you think, wow, this is so beautiful, so powerful. Faith and confidence grows. When the faith and confidence grows, it enables us to act according to the teachings. It is faith and confidence that allows us to think in the right way, to have yoniso manasikara, yeah, the wise attention or the careful attention. Yeah, and that yoniso manasikara becomes then the driver, which drives us on the path, makes us do the right thing. Yeah? And maybe one day, even, you end up as a monastic. Yeah? You think that's likely to happen? Yeah? You end up like this, yeah? So, oh, what happened? I'm a monk now, yeah. It's kind of strange. Sometimes people ask me why I'm a monk. Sometimes I'm not sure. It just happened this way, yeah? Cause and conditions coming together, bang, now you're a monk. Yeah? And I'm very happy to say that some of you have been so brainwashed that you also have ended up as monastics in Perth. We have quite a few monastics from Malaysia in Perth. Yeah, we have two who are kind of alumni of BGF, Lei Han and Lai Peng, yeah, who many of you may know. I know some of you know them already. And they are, one of them is now a bhikkhuni at the Masala Monastery. The other one is a samanera at Bodhinyana Monastery here. And we have many others also from Malaysia, different parts of Malaysia, who are down in Perth. So they have been successfully brainwashed, and they are they are happy for it. Yeah, they probably wonder, oh, how did this happen? And there they are. And I will tell you a couple of nice stories that always reminds me of the importance of Kalyanamitta in my own life. And when I started out my monastic life, I started out in the UK, yeah, under the auspices of Ajahn Sumedho and the Ajahn Chah tradition in the UK. And I was kind of happy there. He was okay. Yeah, I wasn't staying with Ajahn Sumedho. I was staying with some other monk at Chitra's monastery, and it was fine, but I felt that something was missing in my life. You know, sometimes there are certain people that really attract us, that are powerful for us. I don't know exactly why. Maybe a similarity in personality. Some people say karma from the past, or maybe certain habits we have, whatever it is. So but I wasn't fully content in this monastery, and I was always kind of on the lookout for if there was something else. And then one day, I read this discourse, yeah, that has been transcribed. Somebody gave this talk. And I read, I think, whoa, this is it. All I have to do is read one talk given by somebody. This is it. This is so powerful. Yeah. I felt straight away, this is my teacher. And then I did a bit more inquiry. I listened to some more talks. And every time I was absolutely sure, this is it. So then what happened? I decided to call up this person. I said, you know, on the phone, oh, can I come to your monastery here? And this person said, sure, you can come to my monastery here. And so I went to the Sangha in England and said, well, I'm going to go. Sorry. And then, of course, I left that monastery here and I went to this other place. And I knew when I got there that this is it. This is the real teaching. This for me was the Kalyanamitta moment when I knew I'd found somebody I could really trust with the Buddha Dhamma. You know who that person was? Yeah, you know. Okay. Ajahn Brahm, yes. I went to Perth and I've been there ever since. Everybody told me, yeah, you are just restless. You want to leave the country. You want to go somewhere else. But actually for me, it was precisely the right decision. For me, bang, yeah. I feel a very strong kind of connection with Ajahn Brahm. For me, I don't know why exactly, but for me, it is very powerful. I feel the essence of the Dhamma coming out of somebody Ajahn Brahm. I feel more in the presence of Dhamma with him than almost with anyone else. Except if I read the suttas, perhaps. Sometimes the suttas are also very, very powerful. So this is the first, my personal idea of Kalyanamitta. Ajahn Brahm has been the number one Kalyanamitta for me, apart from the Buddha himself. But there are other couple of stories that I like to bring out and talk about, which also are about the idea of Kalyanamitta. And couple of these stories are stories that Ajahn Brahm himself tells. And one of these stories is the story when Ajahn Brahm, after his five reigns in Thailand, he was at Wat Pa Pong, yeah, studying under Ajahn Chah, Lumpu Cha. And after 5 years, it is common as a monastic to then leave the monastery, go wandering around, seek out different teachers, hear different instructions, go into the jungle, meditate by yourself, and do a little bit more your own thing after five reigns, before eventually you settle down somewhere here. And during Ajahn Brahm's wandering, he went to some of the very famous monks in Thailand at that time, people like Ajahn Mahabua. Have you heard about Ajahn Mahabua? Yeah, kind of a very famous monk in Thailand. But one of the monks that Ajahn Brahm went to is a monk called Lumpu Thet, or Ajahn Thet. Ajahn Thet, very famous at this time in Thailand. At that time he was much more famous than Ajahn Mahabua. And he had kind of been made a Chao Kun, and the king had built a mandapa. A mandapa is this, you know, one of these beautiful buildings they have in Thailand. If you go to Thailand, the most beautiful buildings are the temples, yeah? Very, very beautiful temples. And the king had built this beautiful mandapa for Ajahn Thet. This is a large, large building. Very colorful, full of colors of gold and blue and red and all of these kind of things. And so Ajahn Brahm was coming to Ajahn Tate's monastery to visit this very, very famous monk. Many people said he was an arahant. Yeah. And of course, very exciting to see an arahant. Yeah. How do you feel when you think somebody an arahant? Do you feel like, whoa, scary? Yeah. That's what I feel. Whoa, this is a bit scary when you see an arahant. So Ajahn Ram comes into this monastery here, and he goes to the mandapa, because that's where Ajahn Tate is supposed to be here. And he goes in to the mandapa, and he looks around. This large building, looks around. Can't see anyone, yeah? There's nobody there. He's just about to leave. And then he has a second look around. And when he looks around for the second time, he sees this old, ancient man sitting in the corner, at the very opposite corner, yeah? Oh, there he is, yeah? And then he goes in and approaches Lumpur Tate, Ajahn Tate, bows down to him, yeah? He's such a famous monk. He bows down to him and sits down to one side. And then he says, well, at that point, I just felt so peaceful. I felt so nice. I felt so at ease. I was in the presence of this marvelous person. All the questions that I had come to ask, I had this long list of questions, yeah, about all kind of things, they all fell away. They all fell away, because when you are in the presence of somebody extraordinary, somebody who has all these qualities, you feel at peace. You feel at ease. You feel relaxed. And your mind just goes empty. It's a beautiful thing, yeah? It's a wonderful thing when that happens. And of course, the whole idea with Lumpur Tate, when Ajahn Brahm comes into the building, he doesn't see anyone. The reason why he doesn't see Lumpur Tate is because he is so non-self. Yeah, he doesn't make anything out of himself. He's just sitting in the corner. Most of us, at least to some extent, we say, yeah, look at me, here I am. Yeah, we wear nice clothes, we kind of have a makeup on, we do all these kind of things. Yeah, we have the microphone, and we kind of, there's a sense of self there behind that. Yeah, there's a little bit of look at me kind of thing. But when you're an arahant, that's all gone. And when there's no sense of self there, when there's no sense of projecting yourself into the world, you blend into the surroundings. You cannot disappear. So the person here who is the most arahant-like is the one who disappears the most. The one behind the pillar, maybe. No. Yeah, and so this is the sign of somebody who's fully awakened. And Ajahn Brahm said this was one of the most powerful experiences of his life, because he felt totally accepted, completely at ease, completely relaxed in the presence of somebody who is so special. It's a very beautiful time. And even though you have no questions anymore, he said, I felt a bit stupid. I didn't know what to say anymore. My mind was empty. But he also realized it was a good kind of emptiness. So Ajahn Tate asks him, how are you? I'm well. Had a little bit of chat, a little bit of nothing in particular. Then he kind of just walked on without asking a single question from Lumpur Tate. It's beautiful and perplexing at the same time. But this is what happens sometimes when you have real Kalyanamitas, somebody who have a special effect on you. Another very famous incident that Ajahn Brahm talks about was when he went to Sri Lanka. And when he went to Sri Lanka, there's a very famous monk in Sri Lanka called Venerable Nyanavimala. Anyone heard of Venerable Nyanavimala? He was a German monk, yeah? And he was also very famous. And nobody knows exactly whether he was an arahant or Sotapanna or whatever, but very well known for his very powerful practice. And Ajahn Brahm was very lucky. He went to one of the large monasteries in Colombo called Vajirarama, a very famous monastery in Colombo, and he happened to be there at that time. And Bhikkhu Bodhi was there as well, and Bhikkhu Bodhi said to Ajahn Brahm, you know Bhikkhu Bodhi who translates all the books? All the famous monks are kind of around, yeah? So he said, okay, come and visit this monk. This monk is really special. So Ajahn Brahm goes in and kind of bows down to Nyanavimala, and then they sit down. And then he gives them a Dhamma talk. Yeah? And this, Ajahn Brahm said, this was the most powerful Dhamma talk I've heard in my entire life. Probably because they didn't know him, so they didn't know what to expect. And sometimes when you get something you don't expect, it kind of really has an impact on you. For Ajahn Brahm to say that, that takes a lot, because he's heard lots of good Dhamma talks from many good monks. And this Dhamma talk, one of the interesting stories in this Dhamma talk, is the story of how this Venerable Nyanavimala decided to become a monk. Yeah, he's dead now. He died a few years ago. But he basically, that this was an interwar period between the First World War and the Second World War. That's when he became a monk. It was a long time ago. And what happened was that he was walking in the streets in Germany. He was German. And then he came into this building, this thing they call the Bierstube in German. Bierstube is like a pub, basically, yeah, but a German version of a pub. And it's often in the cellar, in the basement. That's where people do bad things, in the basement. It's closer to the hell realms, yeah, down the bottom. So, all happening in the basement. So, all in the bit of the young people drinking away, having a good time. The music is probably loud. Young men and young women kind of amusing each other and having a good time. And then, as he was watching all these people sitting in this Bierstube amusing himself, he noticed that a fire had started in the same building, in a higher floor. A fire was going on, yeah. And the fire was expanding and expanding and expanding. And then he saw that some of the young people, they kind of looked up. Yeah, there's a fire there. Yeah, relax. It takes a long time before the fire kind of takes hold of the building. Just chill. We'll just enjoy ourselves in the meantime. And when it gets closer to the problem, then we'll leave. And anyway, now that the fire is there, everyone is leaving. It means the beer is free because the owner has already fled. Yeah, so we can now enjoy ourselves extra in the meantime. And then, of course, what happens is that some of these young people, many started to leave. They realized it was dangerous, but a few remained. And they remained so long that eventually the whole building came crashing down on them. Yeah, and they died as a consequence. And Janavimala, this famous monk, he realized at that point, he realized this is a metaphor for samsara. This is what existence is like. We enjoy ourselves. We mess around. We do stupid things. We get drunk. Drunk on sensual pleasures. Drunk on alcohol. Drunk on being young. Drunk on being whatever. We get drunk on these things. And in the meantime, samsara comes and bang, crushes us and we are dead. And then we move on to our next life. Yeah? And we forget in the meantime because we are drunk. Because we are intoxicated, because we don't understand what is going on. We don't do those things in life that really matter. We end up doing all kinds of stupid things. And then in the middle of all that, bang, we die. And then we get reborn and we carry on in exactly the same stupid way as we did before. This is kind of the scary thing with remembering your past lives, yeah? You realize, you look back, you realize you've been doing this same thing again and again and again, life after life after life, and never really getting anywhere. That is the problem. And when he saw that, when he saw this metaphor for samsaric existence, when he understood the problem, he said, I have to become a monk straight away. This is what life is like. Suddenly, the ceiling comes crashing in, and then you die, and you're dead, and life is finished. And it isn't like that for most of us. None of us really welcome death. Yeah, okay, now I'm ready to die. Very few are like that. Most of us, we die unexpectedly while we are in the middle of doing things. We're in the middle of our projects. Yeah. I recently heard about this Buddhist businessman in Indonesia, very, very wealthy businessman, owns lots of hotels, yeah, but also very stressed, obviously, because he has so many businesses. In the middle of working out his business, he was so stressed, he had a heart attack and he died. And this is another metaphor for life. We are doing, thinking that we're moving towards a goal, but actually we're not moving towards any goal at all. We're moving towards our grave instead. That's where we are really going here. So where are you going? Towards some goal or towards the grave? What is exactly, where are you heading towards? So remember that, yeah? When you feel that you're moving towards a goal somewhere, your life is heading somewhere. Actually, it is very uncertain whether you ever get there, whether those goals are actually real. The one goal that is certain is you're going to die. Yeah? That is far more important to remember that goal. And then you get some perspective. And then you actually do what is right. And of course, for those people who die in the middle of activity, in the middle of the goals, as soon as you get reborn, those goals are not finished, so you carry on. Yeah. This is why I say, this is why the baby is kicking in the tummy already when you're a mother, because the baby is already running inside the tummy, waiting to carry on in the next life, yeah? Moving towards new goals. So you get reborn, and you carry on, because the idea of goals is so kind of stuck in your mind. You carry on. Craving drives you on towards new goals. Those goals, too, only get partially fulfilled, and while in the middle of pursuing your goal, you die again. And it carries on like that, yeah? on and on and on and on, until one day you decide, okay, enough, let's try out some different kinds of clothes instead. And then things go in a different direction. So these are two beautiful stories of the idea of Kalyanamita, Ajahn Tate, Venerable Gnanavimala, and two things that were very influential on Ajahn Brahm as he was also pursuing the monastic life and pursuing the life of the Dhamma. But the real Kalyanamita in life is not none of these people at all. The real, the most important of all Kalyanamitas is the Buddha. Yeah, the Buddha is number one Kalyanamita. If you want a real Kalyanamita, the one who is the root Kalyanamita, the root guru, yeah, the root guru of all root gurus, the kind of most profound Kalyanamita in our existence, it always is the Buddha. That is what it comes back to. Sometimes when you think about the Buddha, we are kind of a little bit afraid of the Buddha almost. It's just too much, yeah. The Buddha has, his reputation is just too vast. It's almost like, whoa, not sure about if I can take the Buddha as my teacher here. But the point is, you can, yeah. The Buddha is actually a real teacher. One of the things that you start to realize when you start reading the suttas, you read about the life of the Buddha, that the Buddha was actually very approachable. Yeah, in daily life you see ordinary people, they go up to the Buddha and ask him questions. Would you dare to do that? If the Buddha suddenly walked in here, would you dare to ask the Buddha a question? Kind of scary if the Buddha walked in here. And this is kind of the weird thing. We are scared of the Buddha when everything from the suttas shows us otherwise, that actually he was approachable. He was very easy to approach because of the metta and the kindness. So the way to think of the Buddha is more like thinking of this man, yeah, sitting in the forest. And he's sitting in the forest at the root of a tree, yeah, and he looks pretty much like a monk, yeah. He has a shaven head, he's wearing robes. And obviously the Buddha is very peaceful, yeah. He just sits there, and when you approach him, you feel nervous, yeah, because this is kind of a little bit nerve-wracking to approach somebody with such a vast reputation. But as you approach him, it's a bit like coming into the presence of Ajahn Tate. You're coming into the presence of somebody who is almost not there. Somebody with kindness. Somebody with acceptance for who you are. Somebody who embraces you. Somebody who has metta and karuna. Somebody who doesn't judge you. Somebody who understands you, understands your suffering, understands your problems. And you think, but I have so many defilements. What if he reads my mind? He has read so many minds already. He knows what the human mind is like. Your mind is just like every other mind, yeah? There's no difference. Yes, okay, you get angry, you have thoughts of desire, so what? He knows what human minds are like. He has compassion for you. The more defilements you have, the more compassion he has for you, because he knows that you're going to have a long practice ahead of you to actually get there. So don't need to worry about that. And when you sit down in the presence of the Buddha, you just feel at peace. You feel at ease. And when the Buddha teaches you the Dhamma, he teaches you some very simple teachings. Yeah, be kind in your life. Practice compassion towards other people and animals. Don't have too much anger in your dealing with other people. Try to understand them instead. Be generous in your life. Yeah, the basic things of existence. It teaches you something very simple that you can take with you and bring back into your ordinary life and apply in your ordinary life. And that, again, is the idea of a real Kalyanamita. Before I continue, Dr. Wee, how long am I supposed to go on for? 11:15, and a bit of Q&A, and then 11:30, something like that? Yeah, okay. I just want to be clear, so I don't just do something I'm not supposed to be doing here. So, this is the idea of the Buddha, yeah? Someone approachable, someone very kind, someone you feel at ease in their presence. What is it about the Buddha that makes him such a powerful Kalyanamita? What is it about the Buddha that when you read the suttas in the present day, we can still actually understand them after 2,500 years? You would think it would be incomprehensible to us. 2,500 years, such a massive time gap, such a vast change in culture, yeah, from that time to now. How come they are still comprehensible to us? And one of the reasons these suttas are comprehensible after 2,500 years is that when the Buddha gave these teachings 2,500 years ago, he knew that the Dhamma would be lasting for a very, very long time into the future. Yeah, he taught the Dhamma Chakka Pavattana Sutta, setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. He knew the wheel of the Dhamma would be rolling on into the future for a long, long period of time. So because he knew that, when he taught his teachings, he taught them in a way so that they were universal. They were applicable to human beings everywhere. Instead of using too many specific examples from Indian culture, he talked directly to the human heart and the human mind. And we are all pretty much the same. Yeah. This is the kind of the weird thing about humanity. We are pretty much all the same. It doesn't matter which country you go to. It doesn't matter which culture you go to. It doesn't matter how educated you are or what class you come from. The similarities are so enormous. Yeah? So sometimes we take pride in who we are. But really, we are just the same. It's bad news, isn't it? We're all the same. It's kind of, we want to be different. We want to be special. I apologize to kind of pull things back to ground a bit, but it's true. And it's actually very liberating when you feel the same. Because when we feel the same, we can relate to each other. Yeah, in a so much better way. Regardless of background, of gender, of wealth, of education levels, of power positions. Yeah, we can still relate to each other as human beings in pretty much exactly the same way. What a wonderful thing that is. We can take away some of the barriers between us. And that is what is so powerful. And this is what the Buddha saw. And that is why he gave the Dhamma this universal characteristic that is applicable to everyone. So when the Buddha was sitting in India 2,500 years ago, he knew that there would be people today, yeah, coming together, listening to his discourses, coming to the Sutta retreat that we're doing now, listening to Dhamma talks. He knew that people like us would be coming on an occasion like this to listen to the Dhamma. He was thinking about us. He was thinking about you, yeah, each one of you. He was thinking about me. He was thinking about every one of us. Remember that, yeah, when the Buddha gave his teachings, he taught you directly. You are a direct disciple of the Buddha. When you think about that, it's kind of hair-raising. Yeah, the Buddha actually thought about me, is that right? I don't understand much, yeah? No, the Buddha taught you precisely because you don't understand much. Yeah? Precisely because we're all on different levels. The Buddha actually thought about each one of us and none of us. When the Buddha was sitting, there was a large assembly in front of me. He may have been looking at individual people, yeah? And they may have felt, yeah, he's teaching me. But no, the Buddha was already thinking 2,500 years into the future. And he was actually thinking about each one of us. Yeah? Instead. So this is kind of the idea of the Buddha, this vast mind who has an understanding of the Dhamma, which is so much broader than the vast majority of people. So he was almost quite literally a direct teacher of each one of us. He is our teacher right now. When you open the suttas, you read of the word of the Buddha, he is teaching you directly, because that was his intention 2,500 years ago. Isn't that marvelous? Yeah, it's such a wonderful thing to think that the greatest spiritual genius in human history is a direct teacher for each one of us, including myself, of course, including everyone. What a powerful thing that is. And when you read the suttas, it is personal. Yeah, it is meant for you. When you read it, think of it as the Buddha talking to you, because that is quite literally what is going on. And then the suttas take on a new meaning. Instead of being some distant thing that is spoken in different culture that you can't really relate to, no, it is as if you have a teacher right in front of you, talking to you right here and then. Then the suttas come alive. Then of the word of the Buddha has a real powerful effect in your life. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha was so powerful. The other thing about the Buddha that makes him so special is the fact that when the Buddha teaches, he's coming from two things. One is what we might call the wisdom side of things, and the other side is the compassion side of things. The wisdom side of the Buddha is really about understanding the human condition, yeah, or the condition of living beings. And he understands that condition to the absolute core. What does it mean to understand the human condition? What it means is to understand what it is that human beings want, yeah? And it means to understand how we can achieve that as human beings. That's really what it means. So the Buddha understands that everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to be at peace. Everyone wants to feel contentment and fulfillment in their lives. Everyone wants to feel a sense of completion, a sense of satisfaction. This is what we all desire in our lives. And the Buddha could see that nobody is actually getting it. Yeah, people are running around, never really getting the thing that they yearn at the deepest level. And he realized that I have understood this. I have understood the thing that people actually really yearn for. I have seen the solution to this. Yeah, so he had the deepest wisdom into the human condition, being able to deliver to people exactly what it is that we want. He had really understood the answer to the meaning of life. And this to me is the most powerful thing about Buddhism. It is the answer to the meaning of life. Nothing more, nothing less. And once you get that, there is no turning back anymore. Once you understand that, that's it. Yeah? Where else are you going to go if you found the meaning to life? You must be crazy if you go somewhere else, found the answer to the meaning of life. This is it. And that is what the Buddha's teaching is about. And so the Buddha has, that's the wisdom side of things, yeah? He has discovered, quite literally, the meaning of life. The other side of the Buddha is that because he knows that we are not finding that meaning in our life, that we are suffering far more than we actually want, that we're all searching for that happiness, compassion arises in the Buddha, yeah? He has the answer, nobody else has it, so compassion arises in him. And he wants to help people because of that understanding that he has the answer to everything else. So, wisdom and compassion coming together is what drives the Buddha. Everything he does is based on these things. There's nothing more than that. There's nothing in it for the Buddha himself. The Buddha doesn't think, yeah, I can get lots of disciples, yeah, when I have many disciples, I can get all these kind of nice things for myself. Buddha doesn't think like that. For the Buddha, that's all irrelevant. For the Buddha, it's a hassle, yeah. Coming and have to teach all these people. Actually, the Buddha could just go back to his little cutie. He could sit down in meditation, and he could access the most profound meditations that are accessible to human beings. Instead, he gives up his life to teach others purely out of compassion. What this means is that when the Buddha teaches, there is no vested interest. There's nothing in it for the Buddha. There's a negative vested interest. He actually gets only trouble and problems out of it, yeah? No vested interest. The vast majority of teachers in the world, they have a vested interest. They get a salary out of what they're doing. They get maybe status out of what they're doing. Maybe they, if you are some kind of guru, yeah, then, oh yeah, I'm a guru, yeah, these are my disciples, yeah, I am, you feel maybe important or whatever. Or you get somebody gives you something, yeah? It's like I sit here and I think, I get, oh, what is this? This is water, okay. So if that's all you get, it's not so dangerous, yeah? Very small vested interest if you only get water. So, but this is kind of the, for most teachers, there is some degree of vested interest in what you're doing. For the Buddha, no vested interest at all. And what that means is that when the Buddha teaches, it is entirely pure. There is no additional reasons why he teaches, except for the compassion, except for the wisdom that actually brought him to giving those teachings. No vested interest, no other reasons whatsoever. And this is why he is the supreme Kalyanamitta. This is why when you open the suttas, remember that he only teaches for our benefit, absolutely no other reason whatsoever. And this makes, again, the suttas so powerful when you start to read them. So, you know, you start to trust them, yeah, because you understand where they are coming from. So take, in the end, take the Buddha as your Kalyanamitta. Come back to the Buddha. This is the gold standard for what Buddhism is. And if you find it hard to read the suttas, then why haven't you come on my sutta retreat? Yeah. This is how you, some of you haven't seen this, some of you are not. You had this wonderful opportunity. That is where we help you out, so you kind of get more access to this sutta. Next time, you come. Is that right? Yeah? Whatever, it's up to you. But I'm just messing around a little bit. I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, I've got to mess around a little bit. Just in the blood. So, what this means is that once you start to understand the incredible importance of Kalyanamitta as a foundation of the very path, you start to have gratitude towards some of these teachers. Yeah, and this is why today is said to be a gratitude today to Venerable Kesari Dhammananda, precisely because we start to understand the power, the importance of Kalyanamitta. Without Kalyanamitta, there is no path, there is nothing. There's just being blind, not seeing anything in samsara, wandering around, trying to find our way, going from life to life, never actually going anywhere, just round and around, doing the same thing again and again. So Kalyanamitta is so important. And when you do that, you start to feel a sense of gratitude. Reflect on these things. Gratitude is quite a hard emotion to have. Not many people are able to give rise to gratitude. It's actually quite a deep thing. The Buddha says in the sutta that gratitude is only really felt by superior people. If you can feel gratitude, already you have quite a developed mind. Yeah, you're already showing that you are some kind of superior person already. So try to see if you can develop that gratitude on the path. But what is the supreme way of having gratitude anyway? And the best way of having gratitude, and I was just reading this out the other day in the sutta upstairs. I shouldn't tell you, yeah, out of spite, because you didn't come, that was your mistake. I will tell you anyway. So what that sutta says is that the right gratitude for the Buddha is not to bow down to him, to offer incense and flowers, all this kind of thing. We can do that. There's nothing wrong with that. And sometimes it feels good to do that. But that is not really the highest gratitude. The highest gratitude, according to the Buddha himself, is to practice the word that he is teaching here. So if you want to have gratitude for Venerable Kesari Dhammananda, if you want to follow in his footsteps and live in the right way, make sure that you practice the message of the Buddha. Yeah? Make sure that you try your very best to keep the five precepts. Make sure that you listen to Dhamma talks on a regular basis that reminds you of what is important in life. And then as you do that, gradually the path starts to unfold in your own mind. And something starts to happen inside of you. You become lighter. You become more beautiful as a person. You become more bright inside. You are shedding some of the weights that weigh us down, hold us down, that stop us from soaring like balloons. You're shedding some of that. And you're becoming a much better person. And life is gradually transformed as you do that. And if Kesari Dhammananda, if the Buddha, if Ajahn Brahm, whoever it is, saw that this is happening to you, they would feel so happy, because they teach the Dhamma, each one of these people teach the Dhamma for your benefit, so you can reap some of the results of this path. Yeah, and if you don't practice that path, if you don't follow their advice, you're not reaping the benefit that they are wishing for you. So do that, and then Venerable Kesari Dhammananda, yeah, I don't know where he is now, and wherever he is, maybe he's nowhere, who knows. He'd be so happy when he saw that his disciples, the people he has inspired, actually are practicing in the right way. That is the right way to go about this. And then, as you do this, as you practice in this way, you can also bring the idea of gratitude into your meditation practice. I don't know if any of you do any meditation practice, but if you sometimes do a bit of meditation, it is nice to do a little bit, even if it's just, what is the shortest meditation I can think of? 2 minutes, yeah? Even if you do 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, yeah? And this is what I recommend you to do. If you're going to do a bit of meditation, get a nice guided meditation, listen to it, it helps you, put you in the right mood, it helps you out to make meditation possible. And just do it, just to feel relaxed, feel at ease, have a bit of metta in your life. That's really the only reason you need to have to do meditation practice. And then bring the gratitude into your meditation. Yeah, you sit down. All you do is 5 minutes. Yeah, for those of you who are beginners to meditation, just 5 minutes. Listen to somebody's nice voice, whoever that is, whoever you consider a good meditation teacher, and then allow them to guide you into the meditation. And then bring up the gratitude you have for people like the Buddha, people like Venerable Kesari Dhammananda. And when you bring that gratitude up, it's a beautiful feeling that dispels the defilements of the mind like that. This is a true spiritual feeling, yeah? Bring it into your meditation practice, bring it into your gradual training, and as you do that, wow, you're going to have so much more success on the path, in your meditation, in your daily life. These are very powerful and positive things that you can apply on your spiritual path. So, 45 minutes. I'm going to stop there. I try to follow orders. You see, this is actually one of the nice things about being a Buddhist monk is that you're told what to do. I don't have to make any decisions. Yeah, I just told what to do. Okay, so I do what I'm told to. Actually, it's quite nice. Yeah, I don't have to make any decisions. You just look, follow along. It's one of the things you learn. Go with the flow. It actually makes life much easier. So I wish you all the best for your practice, and I hope you get inspired and you feel good about things and you keep on inspiring yourself. Now I would like you to give you the opportunity to ask some questions if you like. I don't really accept complaints, so please don't complain. But questions are okay, or comments on what I have said is also okay. Maybe especially for those of you who haven't come on the retreat, but if you don't have any questions, then anyone is certainly welcome to ask, if you want to ask anything here. Anyone like to ask anything here? Remember, you can become a dum-dum in your future life if you don't ask questions in this life, yeah? So, yes.
With this new technology, so I don't know whether people give excuse or some, of course, they have valid reason. They stay in the house, listen to tapes, also listen to talk through internet.
Yeah.
So just now Ajahn mentioned about Kalyamitra, but more on individual. So is this person doing it right, just stay in the house? Maybe this is a housewife, so got no chance to come to the temple or mix around.
Yeah.
So is it okay to listen to one particular monks and then follow the practice? Or is it better to go to temple or mix around with more people, with Buddhist friends, for spiritual development purpose? What's your comment?
Okay, so I must admit, I think it's one of the wonderful things about modern technology, that it actually brings out the Dhamma into people who don't have time to go to the temple, or they live in a place where there is no temple. I know people who live like in the southern states in the U.S., is very heavily Christian, but they happen to be Buddhist, yeah? And they have no friends around. There's no Buddhist temples around. And then they have the cyber temple, yeah? The cyber temple is there, and they can go on the internet. They can listen to whoever they want to. So I would say I think it's a wonderful thing. And I think that what is the most important thing is that you have something that inspires you in daily life, that enables you to practice the teaching. That is the most important thing. Whether you come to the temple or you do that at home, it doesn't really matter so much. But sometimes you may feel that if you just stay at home all the time and all you see is people on the screen, sometimes maybe the distance is too much. Sometimes it can be good to come into the presence of people as well. It gives an added dimension to Buddhism. Yeah? When you see somebody face to face, you feel a bit more confident perhaps that they are the real deal than when you have you see them on the screen. Yeah? It's a bit too far away. So do a bit of both. Try a bit out. But in the end, it is what works for you that really is important. How do you find that inspiration? How do you find your ability to practice in daily life is supported? That is what really matters. That is the most important thing here. But remember also, one of the reasons why I like so much to teach the word of the Buddha is that there are so many teachers out there. And sometimes it's hard as a monk, it's much more hard as a layperson to know who do I go to? Yeah, this one says X, this one says negative X. Exact opposite. Who do I believe? Yeah, and so sometimes this is one of the reasons I always like to return to the word of the Buddha and try to see what the Buddha says. This is the gold standard. This is what real Buddhism is what the Buddha was teaching us. So it is worthwhile investing, I think, at least a little bit of time into understanding the word of the Buddha. It is not hard, yeah? The word of the Buddha, once you get used to it, actually is quite, to me, is the most straightforward Dhamma you can have is the word of the Buddha. There's just some new translations that have been published very recently on a website called suttacentral.net. This is a good friend of mine called Ajahn Sujato, Australian monk. I come from Australia, not Australian myself, but I live in Australia. And he has just translated all the four Nikayas. He spent 2 years on a small island just outside Taiwan, and all he was doing was translating suttas, six to eight hours a day, yeah, for 2 years, and translated four Nikayas in those 2 years. pretty amazing. But and he has deliberately translated the suttas in such a way that it is more suitable for people who have English as a second language. A lot of people with English as a second language prefer to read the suttas in English. So check that out, suttacentral.net. Maybe you find that is useful as well. So this is... Anyway, some of the advice that I will give you. And then at night, before you go to bed, get the Dhammapada, read one verse, yeah? And then you sleep. Oh, you're so happy afterwards. You sleep. Oh, now I can sleep well. You wake up in the morning, and you're happy, and everything goes well for you. Are you happy with that answer, yeah?
Sadhu, sadhu, okay. Sadhu.
Good.
Ajahn, you... passingly mentioned something about metta and gratitude.
Yes.
And I know we all do, or we practice metta meditation. But is there a gratitude meditation as well?
A gratitude meditation. Well, it is all about reflecting on things in the right way. And I think what is most important is to learn how to reflect on things in the right way. Yeah. I'm sure there is a gratitude meditation out there. You probably have to search on the internet. Maybe you can find something nice. But I am not used to doing that, so I don't really, I don't really have any particular advice. But the idea is to think about things in the right way. And when you think about things in the right way, gratitude tends to arise. It's just like metta, yeah? Metta is also about how you think about other people. If you think about people in a certain way, anger arises. If you think about people another way, metta arises. The root thing is how we think about people. And then that metta meditation can help us to guide the mind in the right direction. So how do you think to have gratitude? Well, you think, actually, what would I do if it wasn't for Kesudamananda? Maybe I wouldn't be here today, yeah? What would I do without the Buddha? I wouldn't be here. I would be lost. I would have no spiritual aspect to my life. I would be just pursuing kind of things blindly without having any broader vision about what life is all about. My life would be so impoverished without that. So you start to understand the incredible debt you have to the Buddha, to Kesudamananda, to whatever person it is that you have gratitude for, to your parents, yeah? It took me a long time, personally, to understand actually how lucky I am to have had parents who have brought me up, treated me well, supported me all the way through, even said yes when I wanted to become ordained, yeah? That was kind of the biggest miracle of all. They said yes when I wanted to be ordained. That was kind of a really hard one. They even did that. So even parents who are so close to us, when people are very close to us, it's very easy to see the defects in their conduct because they're so close. That is true for parents and family members. But with the right attitude, you can start even to have gratitude towards your parents, yeah? By reflecting on them in the right way. So it's all about how we think. It's all about how we relate to people that actually gives rise to this the gratitude. But check out the internet, and you may be able to find some good advice there as well. There are always some people who specialize in certain areas, and perhaps you can find some good meditation on gratitude. Anyone else like to ask a question? I only come once a year, to KL. You're so happy. So happy. Yay. There's no pressure. You don't have to ask any questions. There's nothing to ask. It's good. No problem, sir. Okay, Victor, would you like to wrap up? Proceed. Everyone happy? Yeah. Last chance. Going. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Ajahn, for the wonderful sharing. Before we proceed upstairs for the Mahasanghika Dana at level 1, can you give 3 bows to Ajahn?
Okay. Just tell me what to do, Bobby. This way? Okay. Go ahead.
Should I give you this? You want this one?